Welcome to Modern Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and with me is Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Thank you, Teresa.
We're in show number 77, and we've been discussing the Middle East and
right. All
of the turmoil and the beginnings of this continued saga.
Right, and we've gotten up to the year 1979, which is a dramatic year. It's the year that the Ayatollah Khomeini went back to Iran.
Mm-hmm.
It's the year that the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan. And so we're going to pretty much take up at that part. It's also the year that the American hostages were taken late into that year and in Tehran. And so we'll be taking a look at that. We'll be looking at the developments in Afghanistan, how the jihadist movement comes about, who Osama bin Laden is, and if we have time, a little quote from Pope John Paul II from his book, The Crossing the Threshold of Hope, so that we have a little bit of perspective. If we don't, we'll certainly do that next time, but maybe we'll be able to get that in this time, too.
Okay.
So, last time around, just as a real fast run-up to this, we saw in the development of the 20th century in the Islamic world, two individuals having lots of influence in shifting Islam from being a peaceful personal religion, one of personal worship and salvation with God, to the kind of virulent religion that we're seeing in the jihadist movement today. And that, of course, is first of all Saeed Qutb, the Egyptian, and his preaching before being executed, his preaching of calling Muslim states, the leaders of Muslim states, apostates, and cooperating with the West. Then the other is a contemporary of his over in Pakistan. This is Maulana Maududi, and his preachings also of taking that one step further than and establishing Islamic states rather than Muslim states. Remember, the distinction here is that a Muslim state is simply a country with a lot of Muslims living in it, maybe the vast majority, maybe everybody, but it is not necessarily living by the Sharia, by the Islamic law. And he wants to establish countries that are along those lines. So, and of course, he calls on on all true Muslims to use the five pillars of Islam as sort of a boot camp in preparing them for global jihad, the profession of faith, prayer, Ramadan fast, the Hajj, and giving of alms. And there are two organizations we see that are playing into all of this, too. The first was the Muslim Brotherhood, which came about as a result of the secularization of Turkey. These are people who objected to Turkey becoming a secular republic in the early 20th century after the First World War. They continue to be angry. They're angry young men who become angry old men who convert other angry young men. They're angry about Turkey. They're angry about Egypt because Egypt becomes it's truly a Muslim state. Most of the people are Muslim, but the government itself is not particularly Islamic. And they're angry about the establishment of the State of Israel right in their midst. They're angry about what's happened to the Palestinians and the plight of the Palestinians. They're angry about the influence that the West is having. So they're just angry about everything. And so that's the Muslim Brotherhood. And then you have the change in the whole, if you could call it, seminary system, or the educational system, with the closure of a very highly respected, not sort of a closure, but a takeover, government takeover, of a highly respected academy in Egypt. You end up with lots of others. And then with that, ultimately, the establishment of the madrasas, which are like hardline parochial schools, in a sense, and particularly in Pakistan. This is where everything is sort of like coming together in the late 1970s. All of these trends are coming together in Pakistan itself. And so then we have other trends. As these things are coming together, there are other trends within the Islamic world. You have a common cause against Israel. There's just the entire Islamic world is just angry at that and set against it. You have an incredible population explosion that's taking place. For instance, in a 20-year period, Pakistan itself doubled in size.
Wow.
It's quite a huge population growth. There's an urbanization that's taking place. A lot of people moving in from the rural areas, and when they do that, they tend to radicalize. So that's an aspect happening. And then you also have increased wealth through oil exports in some of those Arab Muslim countries. You know, we know which ones they are. And so you have the export of Wahhabism, which we talked about before. It's a radical form of Sunni Islam. And then in Pakistan, in 1977, there is a coup d'etat. The government is overthrown. The Prime Minister, Ali Bhutto, is overthrown and replaced by one of his generals. And this is General Muhammad Zia ul-Haq. And General Zia is a follower of Maududi. He's a supporter of the madrasas. So the radicalization in Pakistan, Ali Bhutto was a secularizer, looking toward the modernity of his government, and now just the opposite happens. So what happens then in 1979, now that General Zia takes over, he's not a very popular man in the West. But what happens is in 1979, when the Soviet Union invades Afghanistan, if you look at the geopolitical map, you had to use Pakistan in order to stop the expansion of the Soviet Union. So a windfall comes in the form to Pakistan in the form of American aid, and then also Saudi money begins flowing in. And so Pakistan, which had been pretty much isolated, especially in its continued conflict with India, now all of a sudden becomes something of a darling. And so General Zia has, you know, is very happy about that. He uses this money and influence to establish what he calls the International Islamic University. And he does this in his capital city, Islamabad. That's done in 1980. And on the faculty, he invites in specifically Wahhabists, okay, Sunni Wahhabists, and the Muslim Brotherhood. He also is aided by Maududi's organization called the Jamaat-e-Islami. Remember, this is opposed to, from his point of view, Maududi's point of view, these are the shock troops of the new jihad. Okay. And he expands the madrasas, educational system, throughout Pakistan, especially in the northeast part of Pakistan that borders along the Afghan border. All of this then, the institution of the Sharia in Pakistan itself, it seems then that General Zia is in the process of taking Pakistan, a Muslim state, and turning it into an Islamic state. This is the ideal of all of these thinkers. Now, this doesn't come easy. He's got a lot of opposition within his own country, and particularly from other Muslims, because there is a significant number of Shiite Muslims in Pakistan. And they object, particularly they object to a raid on their bank accounts. Believe it or not, in Pakistan, one of the things that was done, making this a truly an Islamic country, one of the things you do during Ramadan is, besides your fasting, you also give alms. Okay? Now, it's supposed to be voluntary, but in Pakistan, what they did was every Pakistani bank had to raid every account 2.5%. So, you can imagine this? I mean, you know, like, here in the West, and you know, Christian country, that you know, think of your own bank account, and on Ash Wednesday, You wake up to find out the 2.5% has been withdrawn from your own savings account or checking account, and it's been given to the government for charitable works. Thank you very much. That's what happens. And the Shiites were very upset about this, what's called the zakat. They're very upset about this. It's sort of like, you know, hey, I gave at the mosque. What are you doing? Mm-hmm. You know, I want to give to my ayatollahs. The Sunnis don't have ayatollahs. The Shiites do. They want to give to the ayatollahs at their own mosques. And basically, General Zia says, fine, go right ahead, but we're still taking your 2.5%. By the way, that's also a very strong incentive not to keep a lot of money in the bank, you know, which is not a very smart move for a country to do. The madrasas themselves, because they're getting this money from the Pakistani government and also from the Saudis, this money is now flowing into these schools, and they become more than just day schools. They become boarding schools, and especially for the poor. So if you can imagine a family of 7, 8 children in Karachi, a poor family, day laborer, mothers taking in laundry. They live in abject poverty, and along comes a mullah, and he says, listen, I'll take your three oldest sons, you know, 14, 12, and 7, and we'll take them to a very nice school, and they'll get a wonderful education. And the family goes, oh, that's wonderful. So off they go to boarding school. And this is like, you know, like a grant or something, you know. And so off they go to these boarding schools. But these boarding schools radicalize the kids. I'm going to read you something in just a little bit about what develops with these children in the madrasas themselves. Okay, they're going to be given a very radical brand of Islam. They're going to be given Wahhabism, the idea of a personal jihad, which is personal jihad within yourself, a struggle within yourself to overcome your selfishness and all the other, your passions and all that, overcome all of that in order to give yourself over to the greater jihad of transforming society into an Islamic state, that the people who are against that are the secularists, are the Christians, are the Jews. These are the enemy, and the kids are getting this from the time that they're, you know, in 5, 6 years old, all the way up until the time that they're 18, 19 years old. Day after day, they're being told this stuff, and there's a real indoctrination that's taking place. Lots of mind games that are happening. In fact, just in the last week, the Saudi government has aired interviews with former members of Al-Qaeda who have turned themselves in. And these guys have talked about the methods in which they were brainwashed in order to do what they do. It's very revealing. Well, included in these madrasas are also large numbers of Afghani refugees, because there's so many people fleeing from Afghanistan because of the terrible fighting that's going on. We'll talk about that in a couple minutes. These then come down into, they cross the border into Pakistan. And many of them are also visited by mullahs, who then take them off to the madrasas. So not only do you have Pakistanis, but also Afghan children enrolled here. And they then become pupils. Okay. Now, I don't know any Arabic. I have half dozen words at most, but we've certainly learned over the last couple of years a few Arabic words, and one of those is talib. It means a student or a pupil. Okay, the plural of talib is taliban. Okay. And as these guys graduate then, after several years in the madrasas, they then are hardened jihadists, dedicated to their religion in a twisted sort of a way. And this is going to become what's known as the Taliban that will take over Afghanistan after the Soviets fail. Anyway, I don't want to go too fast ahead of myself here. The fact is that in 1988, General Zia al-Haq was assassinated. The country then turns over, and goes back to democracy, and the new prime minister is a woman. This is Benazir Bhutto. You see her on talk shows from time to time and late at night. She's still around, not in Pakistan, but she is very, very critical of the present government in Pakistan, as one can well imagine. Anyway, she's swept to power. Now, Mrs. Bhutto is the daughter of Prime Minister Ali Bhutto, who had been ousted by General Zia, who was also later on hanged. Mm-hmm. Okay, so she's got some baggage herself when she comes back, and she is particularly targeting the madrasas, the followers of Maududi, because and the supporters of General Zia, because these people were behind her father being hanged back in 1979. Yeah. Now, let's go back to 1979. The United States looked terribly weak in the subcontinent. And the Soviet Union looked strong. In November 4th of 1979, the United States Embassy had been taken over, and hostages were taken in Tehran. It's 1 month later that Soviet tanks move into Afghanistan to prop up a communist government that was in the process of failing. There are all kinds of Cold War implications for this. The Cold War was still very much on. The United States had just lost Iran as a major ally with the loss of the Shah. At the same time, the Soviet Union looks as though it's driving through Afghanistan. There's chaos in Pakistan. If it is able to get across then into Pakistan, it can get down to the port of Karachi, which gives it then a warm water port in South Asia. Huge influence in the richest oil area of the world. And so the United States was looking for some way to turn the tides. Okay? And what they saw was that you have this huge number of Afghani refugees. There were about 3 million. And they're in camps, either just inside the Afghan border or just out inside the Pakistani border. And that many of these people wanted to go back and fight for their country. They wanted to go back and overthrow the communists. Especially around the city of Peshawar. You hear about this all the time in the news. Peshawar is, every once in a while, is back in our news. There are, among the 3 million Afghanis, there are, the CIA learns very quickly that there are hundreds of Islamists who want to go back in the name of religion and fight the Soviets. That's music to our ears. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so what happens is that you begin having Saudi money as well as U.S. arms specifically targeted then to these people. There's also this is not nice stuff. This is dirty stuff. It's also being pulled by the heroin trade. The Afghans are using heroin in order to buy arms to fight the Soviets too. Like I say, this is a very complex and ugly thing. Two organizations, the CIA and the ISI, which is the Pakistani Secret Service, are working hand in glove in order to help bring about a group of people who will go into Afghanistan to fight the Soviets. Okay. They find themselves, strange bedfellows, find themselves allied to the Jamaat-e-Islami, that's Maududi's group, okay, and plus the madrasas, the graduates of the madrasas. Remember the pupils, the
right,
Taliban,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
What happens is that over a period of years, then as you go through the 1980s, the early 80s, is the Soviets succeed in alienating just about everybody in Afghanistan. They fight that war in the most incredibly inept way, and so I mean you have arrests, massive arrests. Huge executions, the imposition of socialism on the country, and Soviet-style socialism is atheistic. Remember, we had talked about before of the godless creature that forces itself on. I forget the direct quote there, but forces itself on the house of Islam, and so you have a real sense of a religious crusade. I almost use the word crusade. I don't want to do that. A religious struggle then against godless communism. Added to that. This doesn't seem like a bad thing, but they imposed literacy on the country. It's a Soviet standard that everyone should learn to read and write. They also imposed radical equality of the genders, so that women should be able to go to school, decide for themselves whether they want to get married, all these sorts of things, which we kind of believe are pretty fundamental principles ourselves, yeah. But the people in Afghanistan did not feel that way. I think they've shifted somewhat in the last 20 years. They had the election this past year, in which President Karzai was elected then as president of Afghanistan. The first person to cast – this is the first time they've ever had a nationwide election. The first person to cast the vote was, I think it was a 19-year-old woman.
I think so.
Yeah.
I guess so, right.
That's quite an extraordinary change of been over a 30-year period. But what the Soviets tried to do, the way they tried to do it, was so heavy-handed that it just caused lots and lots of conflict. They also tried to change and the agriculture, the way that the Afghans did their agriculture based upon the Soviet style, so-called reforms. Mm-hmm. Well, the Soviets weren't really good at they kind of messed up Russia themselves. Now they're coming down to Afghanistan and forcing communes and the collectivization of farms. That makes no sense at all. But they're being doctrinaire.
Mm-hmm.
These are the last years of Leonid Brezhnev, and they're not exactly his most brilliant years. Well, so there's this war going on. This is a war for a Muslim country against godless communism. And here's something that happens that catches everyone's attention. In 1981, the conference that was held in Saudi Arabia, the Taif Conference, all the Muslim countries gathered to that conference. And at that conference, they all condemned the State of Israel. Whenever you get together, they always condemn Israel. Then somebody brought up, hey, let's condemn the Soviet Union. I mean, look what they're doing to our Muslim brothers and sisters up in Afghanistan. They couldn't get a vote.
Oh, really?
Yes. And the reason was because the Soviets had client states among the Arabs themselves.
Oh.
Syria was a client state of the Soviet Union. South Yemen, a client state of the Soviet Union. The Palestinians are pro-Moscow.
Oh.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
And now, this is an important understanding also, something that missed almost everybody. If you go back and look, ever since the end of World War I, ever since T.E. Lawrence gave hope to the Arabs, okay,
mm-hmm.
there's been a search for hope.
Mm-hmm.
And the first search for hope was a pan-Arab state that did not have a chance. It never got on the table at Versailles. So that didn't work out. Then the next possibility was Arab nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't work out. I mean, they ended up with nations. There is Egypt and Libya and Morocco and Iraq and Syria and, all of those. But it's proven to be not the answer. There was no hope in any of that because they've never been able to pull themselves together. Every time they fight Israel, they lose. They're governments that are barely hanging on their own. Some of them are on life support. So Arab nationalism is not going to be the answer either.
Mm-hmm.
The next answer that comes along is petrodollars, mm-hmm. petro-Islam. Allah has given all of this wonderful oil to the Arabs. To the Arab Muslims. And what happens then is that in this Afghanistan war, for devout Muslims who are very personally upset about what's happening to people in Afghanistan, petrodollar Islam is not solving that question either. They can't even get a vote to condemn the Soviet Union. Now, the key here is that as a result of that, there are more and more Muslims in the world that turn away from an institutional solution and begin looking for a grassroots solution. That's the key here. So Muslim states are useless. They have to come into something else. And that's where all throughout the world, teachers in the mosques begin encouraging their young men to take seriously their religion. That is to say, from a Wahhabist point of view, prepare yourself for the spiritual struggle, but prepare yourself so that when you win the spiritual struggle within you, you can then take that out into the world. And so there you have then the combination of Wahhabism and Muslim Brotherhood. And this all flows into the 1980s. It flows into northwestern Pakistan, around the city of Peshawar, and into Afghanistan. And so all throughout the Muslim world, young volunteers, young men, 16, 17, 18, into their early 20s, leave their homes and go there in order to fight against godless socialism, godless communism. The United States is aiding these people, giving them money, seeing the what's known as the Mujahideen as freedom fighters. In fact, if you remember, listen to the speeches of President Reagan. He speaks of them as freedom fighters. Mm-hmm. Well, they were, except they had another agenda going on that we were not paying close attention to, because our attention was to getting the Soviet Union out of Afghanistan. Okay. What happens is that most of them, and this is the interesting thing, most of the American money that's going, we don't have eyes on the ground. We don't have eyes and ears. We don't know who these people are. So what we do is we trust our friends and our allies, as in this case of the Pakistanis, specifically the ISI, the secret agency, which is the counterpart of the CIA. We're handing large amounts of money over to the Pakistani government, especially to the ISI, and saying, here, give this to the people who can do the most good for it. What we're not paying attention to either is that the Pakistani government, especially the Pakistani army, especially the ISI, is made up of people who are followers of Maududi, who are followers of President Zia, even although he's been assassinated at this point, and they have a government that they don't particularly care for, you know, but they're working for. So what they do is they're actually filtering money to the Afghan fighters. They're not going to filter money to the warlords, okay, or to the Northern Alliance, which is a series of warlords that are combined together. And these guys are on the ropes. They're having a heck of a time fighting the Soviets. They give their money specifically to Arab jihadists. These are fellow Wahhabists. We don't know how many of them were in Afghanistan, but we estimate somewhere between 8,000 to 25,000.
Wow.
Now, it's very smart from the Pakistani point of view not to prop up the warlords, because they're looking down the line. They're playing chess several moves ahead, and they're seeing that if, by some extraordinary means, the Soviet Union actually pulls out of Afghanistan, that you're going to have a power vacuum. You know, once the Soviets pull out, then the question is, who's going to run Afghanistan? And Pakistan, which is the next-door neighbor, wants to have as friendly a power as possible do that, and hopefully a weak power that they can manipulate. They're living in a tough neighborhood. The more friends they can get around them, the better. I mean, over on one side, you've got India, you know, second largest country in the world, and I think it is now the largest country in the world. You've got Kashmir. Disputed, fighting going on there. Over on the other side, you've got Afghanistan. It's pretty rough territory. And beyond that, you've got Iran, which is now a huge Shiite country. So there's a lot. This is a tough neighborhood, and there are a lot of tough people. And so you want to have as many friends as possible in the neighborhood. And so they threw their lot in, not with the warlords, but rather with the jihadists and the pupils, the Taliban, which makes only perfect sense from their point of view because these guys got educated in their schools. They would also be available for other Pakistani purposes. Mm-hmm. And in fact, these same jihadists, these Arabs who are not Pakistani themselves and are not Afghans themselves, these are many of them coming in from Saudi Arabia and other countries. As they're coming in, they're being trained and they're being used against the Soviets, but then also their same skills could be used against Kashmir and also used against Pakistani Shiites to keep them in line. So it's just a really wild thing. Now, the fact of the matter is that the vast majority of these Arabs that go, and they're often referred to as Afghan Arabs. Okay, they're not Afghans at all, they're Arabs. In fact, the Afghanis refer to them as simply as the Arabs, because remember, Afghans are not Arabs. It's a different group of people inside. It's several different tribes, but none of them are Arabs. These Arabs are coming in, and many of them are absolutely useless. What they are is rich Saudi teenagers, guys in their early 20s, and they're on what one author referred to as a jihad tour. And it's sort of like, well, anyway, I'm not going to make any comparisons. Let me just say that what they would do is they would fly from Saudi Arabia. These are rich kids, mm-hmm. okay, from rich families, and they've been lived a life of privilege. They hop on a plane, and they fly to Pakistan. And then from there, they take a bus up to Peshawar. And there in Peshawar, they stay at guest houses, and they have interviews with Islamists.
Okay.
You know, and they receive what's called the radicalization process. They're told about, you know, how they should give their lives and their wealth and everything for Allah and those sorts of things. Then they're taken in cars and driven to Afghanistan itself, across the border. And once they get across there, they have a photo op in which people take pictures of each other. Here I am, I'm in Afghanistan, you know, there I am on the road to Kandahar. Here's the Khyber Pass, I'm standing here, my friends. Then they go back to Pakistan, fly back home, and then they brag about having been involved in the great jihad against the Soviets.
Oh my gosh.
And in actuality, they actually are doing no fighting at all. Now, those aren't the ones you need to worry about. The ones you need to worry about are the ones who have been recruited out of prisons, ex-convicts. Many of them go. Some of them go out of love for their religion. Others go because it's something to do. Mm-hmm. But anyway, these are hardened criminals. Yeah.
Right.
And so they go. They're there to fight. Also, many of them that are arriving are not just jihad tour kids, but these are very smart people. They're well educated. In fact, if you look at the 19 hijackers on September 11th, most of them had degrees. They could have done very well for themselves in the upper middle class.
Mm-hmm.
So many of them are well educated. Many of them are fluent in Western languages, and especially English. Look at Mohammed Atta, he was studying in Germany, in Hamburg, mm-hmm. fluent in German, and had marginal English abilities, but nonetheless. And many of them are computer literate. And this makes them very dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those in that number is Osama bin Laden, who we'll talk about a little bit later on. So what happens then is, the question we have to ask ourselves, well, I found myself asking myself as I'm reading a dozen different books and the best articles I possibly can to make some sense out of all of this, is how do you take a rich Saudi kid, a jihad tourist,
mm-hmm.
as is in the case of Osama bin Laden, this is a guy who grew up with the royal family,
mm-hmm.
and how do you turn him into the most wanted terrorist in the world? You know, and what does all this mean? And the bottom line is this. What happens is in 1989, the Soviet Union called it quits and withdrew from Afghanistan. Now, how they did this ultimately was because of the work of the Taliban. And there is a book I think I had mentioned to you early on as we were giving sort of a bibliography. It's entitled Jihad, The Trail of Political Islam. It's from it's written by Giles Kepel, K-E-P-E-L, and it's just a year or two old. And he says the following. I'd just like to read you part of a paragraph about the mentality of the Taliban itself.
Okay.
Okay. He says this. They, that is the, these are graduates of the madrasas, they had little or no contact with the outside world. Much of their time was spent mumbling texts that they were taught to revere and apply even though they did not understand their meaning. And this experience left them with an esprit de corps that extinguished even the smallest expression of free thought or individual will. In the doctrinaire madrasas, it was a simple matter to turn pupils conditioned in this way into full-blown fanatics. So it's nothing short of what they're experiencing is nothing short of mind
brainwashing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so literally thousands of these young people do that. Now, what happens is that in 1989, the Soviet Union leaves. There's a power vacuum, just as the Pakistanis saw that there was going to be. But the Pakistanis didn't have the power themselves to come in and fill that. They couldn't even manipulate client groups to do that. The United States was totally involved in other things, and so we didn't. What happened was we simply, after the Soviets left, we go, oh, that's wonderful. Good luck. Have a nice life. And so we didn't continue sending our own people in. We didn't school people, either diplomats or spies, in the languages of the people or in the region itself. We didn't send any more money in. We didn't prop up anyone against anyone else. We simply ignored it. What happens then is Afghanistan becomes a failed state. And in 1994, in November of 1994, an incident takes place that changes all of that. Now, up until that time, for about 5 years, ever since the Soviets left, the only power sources were local warlords who controlled their part of Pakistan, of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. Some of them large areas, some of them small areas. They made their money from poppy growing, shaking down people, heroin sales, robbing, kidnapping for ransom, stopping people as they're driving along the roads, which deteriorated very badly. They weren't good to begin with, but they really got bad. And then robbing them along the way or exacting tolls. And that's how they made their money. At one point, there was a convoy of trucks making their way through a region in southeast Afghanistan. And it was stopped by the local warlord. And the people were just being shaken down. And at that point, a bunch of Taliban decided they had had enough. This was not the Islamic State that Maududi had predicted, that Wahhab had dreamed of. This was not what it was all about. And 2,000 of these guys descended on that warlord.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And they saved the convoy. And they freed the convoy, and they told the warlord that if he continued acting in this un-Islamic way to his Islamic brothers, that they were going to come back, and it was going to get worse. Now, that 2,000 Taliban never disbanded. What they did was they went around Afghanistan from place to place doing the same thing to everybody else. And many, many Afghans looked at them and said, bah, you know, these are wonderful people. These are the people who are, you know, they're standing up for law and righteousness and for God, and more people join them. And more people join them until, in time, 85% of Afghanistan was dominated by the Taliban, who then implemented the law of Sharia in every area that they could, first starting in Kandahar in September of 1996, and then ultimately by 1998, they had control of Kabul. And so now they control the majority, not everybody, but the majority of Afghanistan. The single greatest threat to them came from a very charismatic leader of one of the tribes in the north. And he had pulled together a group of these tribes and warlords into what was known as the Northern Alliance. His name was Ahmed Saad Massoud. Massoud was murdered on September 10th, 2001, the day before the assault. There are those people that say that there was a connection between the two. Others say that it was just a freak accident. It's hard to tell. The Pakistani ISI, the Secret Service, continued supporting the Taliban through this as the only way of getting stability in this country. And so the Pakistanis at this point are supporting the Taliban. The Taliban themselves look upon Afghanistan, particularly Kabul, and this is a quote, as a corrupt mob who must be subjected to the rule of Sharia. So when they took over that city, they went through lopping heads like you wouldn't believe. You might remember the soccer park that had been restored by the Americans to a soccer park had been used as an execution field where people would fill the soccer stadium in order to watch women being executed for minor violations of the dress code. And this was just an incredible, incredibly repressive regime. The war itself then continues, Taliban versus warlords, and there were a half dozen of these warlords who were trying to just keep control of their own particular regions. The leader of the Taliban militia, the military wing, he's known as the Commander of the Faithful, and this is the Mullah Omar. If you remember him, he was in Kandahar. He's the guy with the great big beard and the patch over his eye. Mm-hmm. You might remember him. What happens is that he really is the fellow who is he's a mullah, he's a teacher, and these are Taliban, they're students. They really look to him for guidance, and he's the one that gives the okay to give aid and comfort to Osama bin Laden and his followers, and that's how he's able to get into Afghanistan and use Afghanistan then as a staging area for his various assaults, so he gets sanctuary there. It's important to keep in mind that there were only two countries in the world that recognized the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. One of those, obviously, was Pakistan, and the other was the United Arab Emirates, and that was because of commercial arrangements. And in 1999, we're getting really close to the present, 1999, Pakistan became questionable because there was another overthrow of the government. The Prime Minister, Sharif, was ousted by a general, just like earlier on with General Zia. This one is General Pervez Musharraf. When he takes over, he promises to secularize Pakistan along the model of Turkey. So remember, Zia comes in with the intention of Islamicizing Pakistan. He's going to instead secularize it. But he's got some real problems, because the army doesn't want to see it secularized, and particularly the ISI, its own intelligence agency, doesn't want to see it secularized. And he's also got a team of nuclear scientists who have been working on an atom bomb who are themselves Islamists, which is a very scary thought, you know. However, in the late 1990s, there were two other jihads that had taken place. Once the jihadists had succeeded in Afghanistan, there were two other areas where they attempted to spread the revolution to other areas, and these were not successful. And this is kind of important for us to realize, because what's going to happen is, remember, you've got that whole series of Islamic hope. You know, we hope in the United Arabs, we hope in Arab nationalism, we hope in petrodollars, we hope now in this jihad, international jihadist movement. We've succeeded in Afghanistan. Now let's try some other countries, like, for instance, in Tajikistan. Arab jihadists infiltrate into Tajikistan and attempt to overthrow the government there. The government there is a hardline model of an old Soviet government, and they're not successful in there. The other area that we're very much aware of is in 1995, they really breathed new life into a rebellion in Chechnya against the Russians, and that war has been going on, you know, ever since. And you remember just this past year, the terrible massacre of those children at Beslan in southern Russia. That's all connected with that. You remember also last year, the takeover of an opera house in Moscow, of a theater, and the deaths of so many people in that. There are bombings that take place. Russia is constantly under the gun, and some of it's from all of this group also. In Afghanistan, then, Afghanistan is the only example of a successful jihad. And it's looking more and more ugly as the Taliban apply the Sharia to the country. It looks more and more radical. By early 2001, there was a world outcry against the Kabul government. I don't know if you remember this or not, but in part of the country there were these huge Buddhist statues carved into the side of a mountain. And in early 2001, these were blown up. They were destroyed. These were on the list of world cultural exhibits, and they just willingly destroyed this. This is in Bamiyan, claiming that this was part of Shiite superstition. Following this is going into the spring and summer of 2001, lots of non-governmental organization agents, these are care workers, different aid workers, UN workers, were being arrested by the Taliban. There's a notorious example of two young ladies from the United States who were arrested, were accused of proselytizing. They could have had their heads cut off, and through lots of appeals, eventually they were expelled from Pakistan, made their way back to the United States. Both of them were Christian women, but they, to this day, said that they were simply helping people. They were not proselytizing. But that kind of thing became more and more an experience. So more and more young men from throughout the Muslim world who are radicalized in their own mosques, whether they be in Riyadh or Jeddah in Saudi Arabia, or Cairo, or Paris, or London, the United States, you know, Spokane, they radicalize, and then they would express their radical following of Islam by going to Pakistan, to the madrasas, and then ultimately going to Afghanistan. A lot of them are English, the British. And this is because the British finally begin to realize they've got a problem on their hands, and they crack down on a section of London that's been nicknamed Londinistan because there were so many Muslims there. And these are radical Muslims. Remember Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, is from one of those mosques. Mm-hmm. And so this is where Al-Qaeda then finally found a home. It had been in Sudan before that, which we'll say a couple things about a little bit later on. The jihad had failed, as I said, in Tajikistan. It's questionable as whether it will succeed in Chechnya. It failed in Bosnia. That's a whole other story. In Algeria, in Egypt, these were all failures. And so in Afghanistan, you have the one success. And so the Taliban, as much as they're being over, I mean, just incredibly overreaching, still many, many of these Afghan, quote-unquote, Afghan Arabs were flowing into Afghanistan, and Mullah Omar was welcoming them to come in. First of all, many of them were bringing a lot of money, and certainly Osama bin Laden brought not just money, but lots of engineering expertise, so they were very welcomed. And so here is where this organization known as the Base is established. It gets its name then Al-Qaeda, which we'll say some things about a little later on. One of the things that is an insight into the caliber of these Afghan Arabs that are coming. So, in other words, now at this point, you don't have as many of the Afghan tourists, Afghan Arab jihad tourists coming, but instead, these are the hardened criminal people. An example of this should have awakened the West back in the 1990s. I mean, we really slept through the 1990s. On August 24th of 1994, a group of Spanish tourists were massacred in Morocco. They're all murdered, particularly in Morocco. Morocco is a real vacation spot for a lot of Europeans. It's a beautiful country. It's a very nice country. The people are very nice there, and they've got wonderful food, and so it's just a neat kind of a exotic place to go to without having to go to the other side of the world. And these Spaniards were just murdered, massacred in this. The perpetrators of this were caught, some of them in Fez and some of them in Casablanca. And as the investigation got underway, it was discovered that the murderers were themselves not Moroccans, but instead they were Arabs from Islamic communities in, get this, Orléans in France and Paris. Isn't that something?
Yeah.
Yeah. So these are men who had been recruited from France, Orléans and Paris, who are themselves Arabs, Muslims, from radical mosques in France, who then go to Morocco to kill Spaniards because they're polytheists. That is to say, Christians. That's the term that's often used for Christians. Paul, polytheist because what? We believe in the Trinity.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so what you find then more and more is this, at the trial, it comes out that there is in fact an international network that is in operation, fueled by young volunteers, many of them from European communities. So they've learned European languages, learned how to use cell phones, learned how to use computers. They're from housing projects. They had gone to schools that were bad schools. They were just poor schools. They were inner city style schools. Many of them had been arrested for petty crime, had done little bits of time in different prisons. They were involved in violence. They're involved in drugs, which, by the way, is not a terribly Islamic thing to do. Many of them were on welfare. They were getting their livelihood from these Western European countries. Country by country in Europe is slowly waking up to the threat. The Dutch, just in the last couple weeks, have awakened to the threat within their own country with the murder of a filmmaker, a Dutch filmmaker, and the radicalization that's taking place. Now, I mentioned to you the last time around that the Wall Street Journal, this was in last year, February 2003, did an expose of the spread of radical Islam within America, specifically within American prisons. And perhaps we'll end with this and then go on with Osama next time around. But this is a quote from that article. And they're talking about one of the U.S. chaplains. This is a chaplain that is hired by the state of New York. Okay? A chaplain in the prison system. In fact, he oversees the other prison system, all the other chaplains that are Muslim. Imam Umar and some of his colleagues have brought some of the Wahhabism's harshest prejudices to their captive flock. On September 11, 2001, the chaplain of the men's prison in remote Cape Vincent, New York, preached that God had inflicted his punishment on the wicked and the victims deserved what they got, according to a labor arbitrator's subsequent ruling upholding his firing. He was fired for this, for preaching this. And then he turned around and sued the state of New York to try to get his job back. Shocked officials at the prison didn't intervene for fear of sparking a riot. This is in our prisons, our state prisons. About 6 weeks later, the chaplain at the Albion Correction Facility for Women told inmates that Osama bin Laden, quote, is a soldier of Allah, a hero of Allah, unquote, prisoner officials say. New York also has seen a rash of complaints from inmates who adhere to the minority Shiite sect of Islam. So there's tension in the U.S. state prisons between Shiite and Sunni Muslims. Most of these are guys who are converts to Islam. These guys came from, you know, Baptists,
right. Mm-hmm.
Good Baptist families that found themselves in prison and now radicalized. Look at the life of Muhammad, of Malcolm X.
Mm-hmm.
The story is right there. The tensions reflect the centuries-old split between the Shiites and Sunni minority. Imam Umar, that's that guy, and other chaplains have imported into New York's prisons Sunni absolutist perspectives, some inmates say, including a bias against Shiites. Nearly all the chaplains he hired are Sunni. Anthony Cook, now that doesn't sound like a Muslim name.
No.
Okay, Anthony Cook, a Shiite inmate in New York, has been in protective custody since 2001, when other Muslim inmates threatened his life, prison records show. Shiite inmates charged that some chaplains encouraged this kind of animosity by delivering sermons that repeat a centuries-old slur that Shiism began as a Jewish conspiracy to contaminate Islam. Chaplains have handed out religious literature to inmates calling Shiites charlatans, deviants, and enemies of genuine Islam, and the article goes on and on and on. It is incredible. And these guys who are preaching this, these sermons in these prisons, are being paid for by state governments.
Now, why can they pass that stuff out without it being, doesn't it have to go through?
No more than a Catholic priest or a Baptist minister coming in as a chaplain and handing out Bibles or rosaries. Nope. And here's in the United States, the same thing is also happening in all of these other nations, these European nations. What's happening is we're giving radical Islam a buy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we really are. And I think we're beginning to realize this. I hope we're beginning to realize this. Later on, when we get to Pope John Paul II's words about our relationship with Islam, he makes a very clean, I think he makes some incredible insights in a tiny chapter. It's only about 5 pages long. It's entitled Muhammad? And it has some incredible insights into us, our dialogue with Islam, and hope for the future. At the same time, he has some very strong warnings, too. So next time around, when we take a look at our friend Osama, we'll also hear what His Holiness has to say about all this.
Sounds great.
Ooh.
Wow. Okay, Father, thank you. Shall we close today?
Let's do. Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen.
May Almighty God bless you. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen.